You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Tom Gunn, and I'm talking to him on the occasion of the recent publication of his collected poems by Farrah Straus and Giroux. He'd been in Los Angeles on the occasion of a reading in the Lannan Foundation's Reading and Conversation series, and he's the author of the award-winning collection The Man with Night Sweats, The Passages of Joy, Jack Straw's Castle, as well as other books of poetry. Well, I thought I'd leap in right away. You were in an essay that I liked very much on 16th century poetry. You distinguished between the poetry of discrimination and the poetry of abundance. And there seems to be, in your own work, a meandering between the sensuous and exuberant on the one hand and the moral and didactic on the other. And I wondered if you could speak a bit about that.
Well, I'm somebody who does a lot of feeling. I have a lot of sensations. And being human, I think about them as well. So I speculate about them. You know, what was it? D.H. Lawrence was always complaining that people had about certain people who had sex in the head, as if he didn't have sex in the head as well. We all have sex in the head, and we all have our sensations in our head, because we are, as Jiminy Cricket just so wisely said, we're human animals. We're not just animals, we're human animals. We speculate. We are cerebral. Cerebral is an unpopular word, but I don't think it should be. We all think, and there's nothing to be ashamed about it. I don't think we always know what we're doing, but sometimes we find out what we're doing when people tell us afterwards. And somebody told me that in those poems about friends of mine who died of AIDS, he said, "What's interesting is that you're not writing about yourself and your grief. You're writing about the people." And I suppose that was my endeavor, to write about the people. They are thought of as being a kind of memorial. I have a poem, what's it called, The Beautician, where I'm speaking about this woman who does the dead person's hair as a kind of memorial. And these were conceived of as being, yes, not for my own sake, but for them.
But I think as a poet as well, there is an attempt to find a kind of language that will not participate too much in the subject or participate too much in the self either.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned in a reading of one of Pound's cantos that at the beginning of the canto there's an image per line, and it's only midway through that there's a lengthy section of description, and of course with it the eye enters. I sense that there's a desire both to keep the eye circumscribed and to keep events a little bit off from the camera, not to move too close in.
Yeah. I can't add to that, because that seems to be just what my general endeavor is.
Yes, but why?
Well, unfashionably enough, I do believe in a kind of the possibility of viewing objectively. At least I think it's desirable to try to view things objectively, to try to see things as they are. There is an outside world, and we can, at times, if we try hard, see it without distortion and describe it without distortion. It seems to me as some help to try to put that on paper. That's all. This is a general attitude toward the world that I have.
I'm speaking to Tom Gunn on the occasion of the publication by Farrah Straus and Giroux of his collected poems. I'm interested, though, because along with that neutrality, there's a certain quality. I keep thinking of your work in terms of juxtaposed qualities and trying to avoid extremes. And I know in another case, you speak of the danger of the easy cynicism of T.S. Eliot, and on the other hand, the danger of romanticism. And you use the word about a poet you like a lot, and I share your fondness, Mina Loy. The word the word unkind.
Yes.
Could you speak about unkindness? Because there's a certain tinge.
Tell me where. You just find it everywhere.
Yes. It's, you know, in the desire to avoid bathos.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of very careful holding erect and holding off that you know, has the refusal to bathe in an emotion, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you spotted that word with Mina Loy, because I use a Mina Loy, a very underrated and underprinted poet whose selected poems is finally going to come out this fall, I think very soon, from Farrar, Straus and Giroux.
Oh,
and
good.
So she's finally going to become available from a major publisher. And she's one of the great modernists, and she flourished largely in the 19-teens and 20s, though she went on writing until the 1950s. And there is this unkindness in her. It's the unkindness often of the satirist. It's the unkindness of the elitist. It's the unkindness of the woman who has contempt for fools, which I find absolutely terrific. It's something you don't find very much in poets, though, of course, the modernists did have a tendency towards satire. And you do find that in what apparently I call the cynicism of T.S. Eliot. It's a different kind of unkindness with Eliot. In the poems where he's unkind, it takes the form very much of contempt. Hers, I find a much fairer kind of unkindness. Where Eliot has contempt for Jews, she has unkindness toward fools, which is not the same thing at all. She was, of course, Jewish, so she probably wouldn't have been anti-Semitic anyway. I respect this greatly in her. It's very difficult analyzing one's own work, and a writer is not the best person to do it, because you don't notice the things that are most salient. So I'm so perfectly prepared to take it from you that I'm unkind. It's not an intention of mine. Oh, you mean you say a tinge of unkindness?
Yes.
A tinge of unkindness is rather dignified, I think.
Well, I would be the last person to complain about someone's unkindness in a part of the world in which, you know, kindness has been industrialized as an effective metaphysical enterprise. But I sense, we'll get back to the third section of the book, which you described as sort of a grab bag. How to put this? Am I right in thinking that the poems in that third section had been published in a pamphlet called Undesirables? Are those the ones?
Some, yes. Mostly free verse poems.
Yes. And that since Undesirables is a frequent term for street people, but it carries the undertones in these poems that are largely about desire of people who cannot be physically desired, although in some of the poems that possibility is even considered. In one case, you stop to think about whether you're not giving money to a certain beggar because he's not handsome enough.
Yeah.
And in another, a sexual extreme lubricated conjunction is hypothesized.
Which poem is this?
I
don't recognize it.
Really? Tenderloin.
Oh, Tenderloin. Oh, right. Yes. Let me say, to interrupt you, that though my subject in these is undesirables, I think myself as an undesirable, too. I think anybody worthwhile is undesirable from the point of view of bourgeois society. But these are... Yes, I suppose the second section could be called Undesirables. I didn't really think of its connection with that pamphlet, which came out earlier. It was a selection of mainly the free verse poems that are probably mostly, as you say, from the third part.
Well, I'm going to ask you actually to read Tenderloin because it is such a pronounced example of that. This is Tom Gunn reading the poem Tenderloin from his collection, The Man with Night Sweats.
Tenderloin is the name of a section in many a city. I don't know whether Los Angeles has one, but New York, I guess, had the original Tenderloin, and San Francisco certainly has a Tenderloin, and this is more about the San Francisco Tenderloin than any other. Tenderloin. This poverty recognizes a street only as link between corners greasy with expedient, corners turned or waited on, slippery as they may be, for transactions or news of them. Not poverty beaten down, poverty rather on the make, without being clever enough to make it. Smallish sums pass hands. This poverty seeks out stereotype. Gentle black whore, foul-mouthed old cripple, snarling skinhead, tottering transvestite, etc. City romantics. Come on, you. Obey your impulse. Costs only a little more than in the country. It's also slippery, but you might say one lubricant is as good as another. And there's no such thing as an insincere erection, is there? Think of Spanish Fly. It irritates the urethra, which has been capable, however, of responding to more delicate stimuli. And of the loins, too, firm, open slopes that lead to the padded valley. Tender loin, protecting the serviceable channel and glands, delicate almost as eyeballs, tenderness anesthetized and irritated. Strip it bare. Grease it well with its own foul lubricant, against the grit of its own sharp corners. Scrape it to orgasm.
Tom Gunn reading his poem Tenderloin from The Man with Night Sweats.
This is the nastiest poem in the book, certainly, and one of the nastiest poems I've written, one of the unkindest poems I've written, as opposed to a poem like All Do Not All Things Well, for example. I don't know that I have anything to say about that, yeah.
I wondered, though, because you have spoken movingly in your essay on Ivor Winters about, you see, for a very long time, to be personal, I was afraid of your poetry because I knew you to have been a student of Winters, and I was afraid of the healthfulness of the Winters influence. You know, there was that sense that if poetry had nothing to teach us, it had better not be at all, you know, that a poet had to somehow resolve his dark impulses before the poem starts, and I always was afraid of it. And so when I came to your work and I realized, well, like most poets, no one stays under the wing of the teacher, and there's a lot of movement forward. But I did wonder what it had been like to move out of that influence in announcing yourself publicly as a gay poet, in treating certain subject matters, in bringing formal values to subject matters that are regarded widely as refuting form.
Well, you're bringing up a great deal there. First of all, I think you're possibly a little unfair to Winters in thinking that he only dealt with the didactic and healthily didactic, or positively didactic. That sounds more like Matthew Arnold. Though not Matthew Arnold's poetry, interestingly enough, nor Winters' poetry. Winters' poetry is very melancholy. He was a rationalist, and he saw everything as pretty screwed up because he was a rationalist. And so it's hardly happy poetry in the vigorous gymnastic healthy sense that you're speaking of it as being. Of course, I was always queer, and this, of course, this is one reason I always knew I wasn't undesirable. Also, I'm a sensualist. I love it. I mean, I love the opportunity that drugs gave me to, which is rather unfashionable nowadays, but was fashionable in the 60s. That drugs gave me to explore new sensations, new ways of perception. I never found myself I looked forward to those, to that kind of thing, ever since I read The Life of Rambo by Enid Starkey when I was 19. And I'm sure Enid Starkey would have been horrified to think that she was unconsciously evangelizing in that way.
Well, if Rambo won't get you, De Quincey will.
So have I answered your question? I think I have, yes.
Yes. I had the fortune, and this was probably why I had the fear of Ivor Winters, of studying with Hugh Canner. And there was a...
That must have been wonderful.
It was an extraordinary experience. Yeah. There was nothing, you know, like Donald Davey examining the field of diction of a poem. He would look at a poem by William Carlos Williams, Hugh Canner would, and announce... needle points. This word would not appear in a poem 50 years earlier. Let us bear in mind. And he would slowly, without even beginning to discuss the meaning of a poem, poke and prod at its field of rhetoric until you began to see the age it exemplified. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about the age. You say of the 16th century poetry anthology you... review very favorably in your book of essays, Shelf Life, published in the Poets on Poetry series from the University of Michigan Press, that the great virtue of that anthology is that it brings a healthy sense of the political times as well as the personal occasions of the poems. And I sense very much in your own work that there's a sense of importance of the change of time, of the cultural environment.
Definitely.
I think the Passages of Joy, for instance, is the best example. Probably there are very few others of that sense of exuberant promiscuity, of physical discovery of the life in San Francisco in the 70s.
Yes.
And The Man with Night Sweats obviously takes into account the quality of life in a post-AIDS 80s. What is the importance of the immediate, the political, to the poem?
Well, I've lived through an extraordinary time. And from a literary sense, it has been this. When I first started to publish, my first book came out in 1954. If I had openly queer poetry in that book, it would not have been published. For one thing, the publisher would have had the sense not to take it because he would have ended up in the courts in Britain, probably in here. People, that kind of thing could not be published at that time. Then we had the Lady Chatterley trial. Then we had the trial of Allen Ginsberg's Hull in 1956, I think it was. And then the last book, I think, to be banned in Britain, though I was no longer living in Britain, was Burroughs' Naked Lunch. And after that, anything could be printed. Terrific. Finally, everything could be printed. So this was simple wisdom. You didn't write openly gay poetry. You didn't write what couldn't be printed. It would have been foolish. From about sometime in the 60s, you could still write such things. Rather late in the 60s, I think, because I suddenly remember Lenore Kandel's... book of love poetry, I forget what it was called, which was harassed and put on trial in about 1968 or something like that. So it wasn't until about then, before the gay movement, before Stonewall, in fact, that but only just before that there was a complete lifting of censorship. Yes, of course. I mean, you pointed to the landmarks, definitely. I didn't come out of the closet, except all of my friends, you know, but I didn't come out of the closet to the public until it was absolutely safe to do so. I didn't want to get kicked out of the country. I didn't want to lose my job teaching, which I suppose was a possibility, though Berkeley has always been very nice about me, and everybody was new about me. They just didn't talk about it, just didn't talk about such things. But when it was absolutely safe to come out of the closet, I came out after everybody else had, with, as you say, about 1971, wasn't it? No, 1972, the Passages of Joy.
In T.S. Eliot, although Kenner, for instance, would talk about parts of the four quartets being actually physical descriptions of the London Underground, there is the sense of a poem that's being written for immortality, with the identifying physical marks being removed or scraped or eroded from the poem. Your poetry has always been interested in contradicting that. It's very much of its time. It draws parables from its time. And I wanted to ask you about that.
I love the specifics from which the poems arise. In one poem that you mentioned, one called Improvisation, I mentioned ding-dongs, which actually I've never eaten, but I know that people do eat them. And I know they're a kind of junk food that people like a lot. Yes, that's terribly important to me, the specifics. I was very relieved when the word universal got into bad odor recently, I mean the last 10 years or so, because I've always disliked the word universal. It seems to be an evasion of the actual occasion of a poem. And the more universal you try to get, probably the more vaguely you're going to write.
Well, I was astonished, in fact, to find that a whole flock of the phrases from the first of the four quartets appear in a story by Kipling called They. It's a story in which he's driving through...
It's
a great story.
Well, the audience might like to know.
The narrator is driving through a veil, essentially, of dead souls, and Kipling, ostensibly the narrator, whose daughter has just died, is in the story going to be kissed on the palm by the ghost of his dead daughter. But the birds and the fountain and the mysterious warblings that occur in the Eliot are there very clearly and unmysteriously, given a supernatural story in Kipling. So I wanted to ask you about how the specific becomes the allegorical or the spiritual or the mysterious. And is that a process of time or is that built into a poem?
Well, in the actual composition of a poem, It may be a process of time. I find this very difficult to answer because every poem is different and every poem is composed differently. Sometimes, something will happen, let's say, on a particular day and you write a poem about it the next day. Sometimes something will happen and you don't write a poem about it for 20 years.
Well, let's approach it by talking about the last poem I'll ask you to read, All Do Not, All Things Well, also from the collection The Man with Night Sweats.
Okay.
This is Tom Gunn reading for All Do Not, All Things Well.
The title comes from a poem, a song, by Thomas Campion, and about the turn of the 16th and 17th century. It's about the winter occupations of the great house in Elizabethan times. Campion says, all do not all things well. Some measures comely tread, some knotted riddles tell, some poems smoothly read. Well, this is about some people on Cole Street in San Francisco. This happened in the 1970s. I didn't write the poem until the 1980s, to about 12 years later. The title is also the first line of the poem. All do not all things well. Implies that some, therefore, do well for its own sake, one thing they undertake because it has enthralled them. I used to like the two auto freaks, as I called them, who labored in their driveway, its concrete black with oil, in the next block that year. One, hurt in jungle war, had a false leg. The other raised a huge beard above a huge Hell's Angel belly. They seemed to live on beer and corn chips from the deli. Always with friends, they sprawled beneath the ruined car in that inert but live way of scrutinizing innards. And one week they extract an engine to examine, transplant shining like tar, fished out into the sun. It's all that I enjoy, said the stiff-legged boy. That was when the officious realtor had threatened them for brashly operating a business on the street. An outsider, that woman, who wanted them evicted, wanted the neighborhood neat to sell it. That was when the boy from Vietnam told me that he'd firebomb her car. He didn't, of course. She won. I'm sorry that they went. Quick with a friendly greeting, they were gentle, jokey men. Certainly not ambitious, perhaps not intelligent, unless about a car. their work, one thing they knew they could for certain do with a disinterest and passionate expertise to which they gave their best desires and energies. Such oily-handed zest bypassed the self like love. I thought that they were good for any neighborhood.
Tom Gunn reading All Do Not All Things Well from The Man with Night Sweats. Now, the third time I read the poem, I saw it as a statement that moves beyond its particulars about the qualities in poetry that you most appreciate. The bypassing of the self, disinterest and passionate expertise. And it seemed to me that the poem both proclaimed its occasion, a certain place, certain people, and also was a figure for the kind of passion that you most appreciate as a writer. So I guess what I'm talking about is that sense that the poem is a two-headed beast, both particular and symbolic or allegorical, that the time and the accuracies reside in it, but I suspect as time goes by, it will come to seem a statement of intent about your own work.
This is very interesting, because I didn't mean it as such. But I'm speaking, really, I mean, it's a surprise to me that you say this. But it's, in a sense, it's not a surprise. These, I'm speaking about the qualities that I like in people, or that I like in a neighborhood, or in a community, whatever you want to call it. This, if one is consistent, these are going to be the qualities that you also want in writing. So it figures. I'm not displeased that you find that. I'm surprised.
I've been talking to Tom Gunn, the author most recently of The Man with Night Sweats. His collected poems has been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, pop.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.